It went from a crown fire to a ground fire, and the guys were able to hold on to it and protect the village. It was what I refer to as a magnificent save.
Crews battle fires as hot, dry conditions continue. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 28th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a success story from humble beginnings.
Then they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a CEO. And they're laughing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System says it has received federal approval to restart the 800-mile line after a spill this week. The line has been shut down since Tuesday, when Alyeska Pipeline Service Company said a power failure during a planned shutdown allowed several thousand barrels of oil to spill into a partially filled storage tank. Alyeska spokeswoman Michelle Egan says the shutdown was the pipeline's longest in at least a decade. Egan says the company received authorization from the Federal Department of Transportation to resume. She says that will be sometime later today. The pipeline will be returning to full capacity within the next 24 hours. Fire crews and village residents fended off the advance of a wildfire approaching Tanacross yesterday. State Fire Information Officer Pete Buist says local firefighters who stayed behind in the evacuated village used a fuel break constructed in recent years to hold off wind-driven flames.
The fire slammed into that fuel break where the vegetation had been thinned, and it went from a crown fire to a ground fire, and the guys were able to hold on to it and protect the village. It was what I refer to as a magnificent save.
The 4,000-acre Eagle Trail fire continues to burn west of Tanacross, along and across the Tanana River and Alaska Highway, which has been closed at times. Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlos says the blaze has been burning in more favorable direction today, but there are still concerns.
It's slowly moving away from the town of Toke, away from the town of the village of Tanacross. So those are all good things. There are some structures that are along the side of the highway that we're doing structure protection. And also there's the old Mansfield Village, which is basically on the northwest corner of our fire perimeter.
Sarlo says the plan was to send in smoke jumpers to protect the historic but uninhabited site this afternoon. She says crews are also trying to keep fire away from the Alcan Highway and cautions travelers to drive slowly and keep their headlights on in the fire zone. The other high-priority fire in the state is burning along the access road to the Pogo Gold Mine near Delta Junction. The blaze is 25 miles from the mine site, but threatens power transmission lines that lead to the mine. There are 11 staffed fires statewide, including two burning near the Elliott Highway north of Fairbanks. Wildfires have been springing up all over the interior as hot, dry weather and thunderstorms provide ideal conditions for starts. There were 20 new fires yesterday statewide. Blazes cropping up in high-risk areas are being jumped on quickly, while most of the 67 active blazes are in remote country and only being monitored. More than 74,000 acres have burned so far this season. The U.S. House voted late yesterday to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law that forbids gays and lesbians from serving openly in the military. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, it's seen as a big step toward rolling back the Clinton-era law.
The Democratic-led House plan is seen as a compromise and wouldn't change things immediately. The repeal would go forward 2 months after the Defense Department completes a report on what having openly gay servicemen and women would mean, and once military leaders determine that it would not be disruptive. That report is due December 1st. The House vote came as an amendment on a larger Pentagon bill and was mostly along party lines, 234 to 194, with only 5 Republicans in favor and 26 Democrats opposed. Alaska Republican Don Young voted no and says he disagrees with even taking the vote while the U.S. is engaged in combat.
This is a terrible thing to do to the military right now. To get this out in the open, people don't understand the effect upon a combat-ready unit. It will, I think, wreak havoc. And if you have a different bent, you're not promoted, you could use that as a reason why. It may not be that, but that's what would happen.
Young notes that the chiefs of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines have objected to Congress moving forward and say the Defense Department report should come out first.
I would suggest that you'd probably have to have different barracks. Because I don't think it would be compatible. I know it wasn't when I was in the service. It didn't work.
Over on the Senate side of Capitol Hill, Republican Lisa Murkowski says, like the heads of the military branches, she wants to wait until the report is done. She says many of her constituents have weighed in, saying the law should not be repealed. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, support ultimately repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That resonates with Democratic Senator Mark Begich, who's backing a plan like the House one, crafted by Connecticut Independent Senator Joe Lieberman.
As Secretary Gates said, it's not if, it's when. And I think the Lieberman compromise is a good step to kind of set the message that we're ready to move forward. We'll wait for the military and the president to sign off. Once they sign off, then that law should go to the wayside.
On Thursday, Begich's Armed Services Committee made what's viewed as another landmark step toward throwing out Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The committee came down 16 to 12 in favor of Lieberman's bill, with one Republican, Maine's Susan Collins, Begich, and all other Democrats except Virginia's Jim Webb voting to lift it. Begich says he thinks it's a good compromise and lets the military lead the way.
Now that we have gone through 8 years of a war, fighting side by side with countries who do not have this discriminatory act, the net result is we have not diminished our readiness, and that is proof in the pudding. But I recognize the military wants to go through a process, and I'm respectful of that. But at the same time, I think the policy should move off to the side now and move on.
Begich stresses that nothing would change until the Pentagon report about the effects of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and once the Defense Secretary, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President all certify that it won't hurt military readiness. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an innovative idea for helping Gulf Coast victims capture oil.
Homer's amazing. Every salon in Homer and dog groomer and alpaca farm, they've all come through.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
A Sitka Democratic Party official is saying Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams will challenge Lisa Murkowski for her seat in the United States Senate. McAdams, meanwhile, has made no announcement, has not filed paperwork, and says he has no comment. District 2 Democratic Party Chairman Keith Nitre says a report from the online newspaper Alaska Dispatch naming McAdams as a Senate candidate is accurate. McAdams was elected mayor of Sitka in 2008. He's also served 6 years on the Sitka School Board and currently works as director of community schools for the Sitka School District. McAdams is expected to make an announcement on Tuesday. The news comes 3 weeks after Alaska Democrats held their state convention in Sitka. The convention dismissed without a challenger to Murkowski. According to a state website, the race for Murkowski's seat also includes Democrat Frank Vondesar of Homer, Republican Joe Miller of Fairbanks, and Libertarian Frederick David Haas of Anchorage. South Central Foundation President Catherine Gottlieb took an unlikely path to success. She's now in charge of providing health care services to nearly 60,000 Alaska Natives in the Anchorage area. But at 16, she was a high school dropout. APRN's Annie Feit has this profile for our series on Alaska Native education.
Catherine Gottlieb saw the power of education early on. In grade school, her family moved from Old Harbor on Kodiak Island to Seldovia. She says she went from getting straight A's to nearly failing because the standards in Seldovia were so much higher. The teachers expected a lot from her, and she was eager to prove she could do the work. She says the experience taught her the importance of expectations, something she learned from her father as well.
My father had a funny way. He is Filipino. My mother was Aleut. And his second language was English. And because of that, people would yell at him. They would holler at him when they were talking to him. And he one day said, "Why are you yelling at me?" He said, "I can understand you." And I think that's his real good analogy about education and how you're taught.
Domestic violence was common in Catherine Gottlieb's home, and her mother was an alcoholic. But she doesn't blame her rough childhood for her decision to leave high school after 10th grade. Instead, she says it was a simple lack of sex education.
I dropped out of school because I was pregnant at 16 years old, one of those statistics, and decided I should just stay at home, take care of baby, grow up.
Gottlieb went on to have 6 children. She eventually got her GED and worked at her local Native organization. When she was 35, she moved to Anchorage and walked into an employment agency with a lofty goal.
And they said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be a CEO." And they're laughing as I, you know, while I was talking to them because they're looking at my record and I had GED. But I just always felt that I could just do it.
Gottlieb found a job at South Central Foundation. It was a young organization at the time, with 100 employees and an annual budget of $3 million. Its mission was to improve health and social conditions for Alaska Native people. Gottlieb saw that it could be doing much more. She wanted the foundation to help own and manage Indian Health Service programs in Alaska. 4 years later, the board elected her CEO. She says it's the only moment in her work life when real fear set in.
And I didn't know I was worried or scared about it until I was in Juneau. And Brian Saylor had just been appointed the deputy commissioner for the state of Alaska of health. And we were walking down the hill together in Juneau. And I said, "Are you scared?" He said, "Yep." He said, "Are you?" I said, "Yes." And I think that was the first time I felt the awesome responsibility of actually being the person in charge.
Gottlieb realized her vision for South Central Foundation. Today, the organization has 1,400 employees and an annual budget of $181 million. Along the way, she earned a college degree, a master's, and even a pilot's license. And she wants her employees to have the same opportunities. She even offers scholarships to encourage employees to go back to school.
Any bachelor level walking around, we're chasing them back into school for their master's. We believe everyone should have a chance at achieving what their career is here. And if they can do it better with education, we're going to give them a foot up there and encourage them to do that and celebrate it big time if they accomplish that.
She wants to encourage others to adopt her own can-do philosophy, to set a big goal and then go after it, and to ignore anyone who laughs at such ambition along the way. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Most Iditarod reporters like to focus on the race leaders, the slick teams up front that make the rugged 1,000-mile race to Nome look easy. Not Craig Medrid. The longtime Anchorage reporter has always been fascinated by the mushers that struggle and are eventually forced to abandon their dream. During this year's race, he collected the most heartbreaking stories of defeat in a book called Graveyard of Dreams, Dashed Hopes and Shattered Aspirations Along Alaska's Iditarod Trail. Medrid followed the race by snow machine, which he says was its own adventure.
Probably shouldn't say this, but some of the funnest parts were when I could just kind of be away from everyone and take off and spend time on the snow machine by myself and have quiet moments out there. And I think everyone in the race shares that. And if the book lacks anything, is it doesn't quite capture how it's this odd combination of a social event and an antisocial event, in that I think everyone likes being away from everyone else, but then they all kind of like being together too. So it's kind of a commentary on the human animal that, you know, we really don't like people, but we have to have people.
Give us some examples of why mushers were forced to give up this year.
I think most of the people who failed, it just kind of became an overwhelming task to keep the dogs functioning, to keep the dogs happy, to live with the dogs, which, I mean, to somebody like Rick Swenson or Martin Boozer is really easy, but it's not simple to make a bunch of dogs into your family. I mean, it's, you know, they have different little personalities, they have different little needs, they don't always get along. It's like having, you know, 16 three-year-olds, and your job is to keep them all kind of working together every day, and it can be overwhelming.
Did you find that mushers who were failing, were they willing to tell their stories?
When people's hearts are broken, they want to tell their stories. I mean, everyone wants to tell their story, and often, you know, you're kind of conflicted about getting them to do that. It often makes it better for them to tell their story. In fact, it almost always makes them better to unburden themselves and just tell their story. So, yeah, I found them very cooperative and very, very, very willing to talk, even in some very difficult circumstances. In fact, a couple of cases when I just kind of like stopped the interview because it was really more than I wanted to know. It was almost too personal as to how involved people were.
Craig, you write a lot about Iditarod or mushing addiction in the book. How real a phenomenon do you think this is? And why does this particular sport have the power that it does over people?
Well, I think it's a very real addiction, and I think a whole bunch of people admitted that. And I write about old David Azenbrave from Talkeetna, Isle. He used to live in Willow, I think, did it seven or eight times, never did make it. And I think the most revealing thing wasn't talking to him, that when he finally decided, and he's in his 70s now, that he had to quit, he had to sell everything. I mean, he couldn't just sell the dogs and the harnesses and the sleds. He had to sell the dog houses and everything and move, because the draw to go back was so strong that he was afraid that if he looked out there and saw an empty doghouse, he'd get a dog to put in the doghouse and it would all start again. It's a very serious addiction, and I don't know, it's hard to describe why. It's like most addictions. I think part of it is the fascination with the, you know, with the romanticism of it. I think part of it is that the dogs grow on you. I mean, we all know how dogs are. Every one of us who has a dog, you start treating it like family. If you get a whole bunch of them and you're treating them like family, and you get this idea they all want to go on this adventure to Nome, you feel bad if you don't take them. You feel bad if they don't make it.
So, Craig, how crazy do you think someone has to be to even attempt this race, the Iditarod?
I don't know. It's being romantic crazy. You have to be a romantic. You have to have that vision of Jack London and Sergeant Preston and all those kinds of things. And, you know, I don't know if those people are crazy. And if they're crazy, is it a good crazy or a bad crazy? I mean, it's a good thing to have dreams. It's a wonderful thing to have dreams. As someone who loves dogs, I think it's kind of cool to love dogs. You know, I think it's wonderful that people dream about doing it. Now, whether or not some of them should do it, that's another matter. But, you know, crazy's not a bad thing.
Craig Medrid is a reporter for AlaskaDispatch.com. His new book is called Graveyard of Dreams.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Governor Sean Parnell has signed firearms-related legislation, including a bill that pledges protection for in-state gun makers. At a stop in Fairbanks Thursday, Parnell signed House Bill 186, which defines Alaskans' right to manufacture firearms, ammunition, and gun accessories for in-state use, free of federal regulation. There's minimal in-state firearms manufacture, but Parnell says the bill is an important stand against potential federal control efforts.
If you look around us, I mean, even today with OCS regulation, with the president by fiat, by executive order, declaring wide swaths off limits for exploration, if you consider that in the Tongass, they've just now squeezed out our timber industry by a stroke of the pen, when you consider they're trying to zone our oceans with marine spatial planning and setting a national policy over us, or with education, they're setting national education standards over us, we're saying in this area of firearms, we're reserving that to the state and to our people. We're going to be free from federal regulation in this. So whether or not it affects a few or many, it's important because it's about our freedom.
Firearms Freedom Act sponsor Fairbanks Representative Mike Kelly says the legislation makes clear that the state is behind Alaska makers of guns and ammunition.
This bill, in addition to its other provisions to permit the manufacture in Alaska, says we will defend that person, legally defend that person.
Kelly says the bill cannot guarantee a state legal challenge to federal regulation, but implies support and funding for such action. Juneau is hosting its first state high school sports championship in nearly a quarter century this week. The boys and girls soccer tournaments are being held at Thunder Mountain High School and Adair Kennedy Park. The last state championships played in the capital city were the boys and girls basketball tournaments in 1986. KTOO's Casey Kelly has the story.
The home crowd reacts as Juneau's Daffodil Ellison scores a goal 5 minutes into Thursday's game against Wasilla. Juneau Douglas High School's girls and boys teams both qualified for this year's state tournament. That's not at all surprising given the recent success of both teams. But this year's tournament should be special for the Crimson Bears since they get to play on their home field. Senior goalkeeper Kristen Derrick knows what she likes about playing at home.
Yeah, I like having it here, and I like sleeping in my own bed and staying at home, and I don't know, it's nice because you don't have to travel or anything.
JDHS girls coach Matt Dusenberry says the whole not having to travel thing is nice for parents, too.
Oftentimes when we travel up and play in Anchorage or Wasilla, wherever they hold the state championships, typically the only fan base we have are those senior parents.
On the flip side, JDHS boys coach Gary Lenhart says he prefers to travel.
You know, I kind of liked coming out of town and being the underdog and under the radar and having all the guys in the hotel. And so I have to admit, I was a little disappointed when I heard that we were going to be here, that I wasn't going to be able to, you know, my kids will be in school, I'd be teaching. But watching it and the beautiful weather, and I think it's great for the city of Juneau. It's certainly fun for these kids' parents.
John Andrews is director of state tournaments for the Alaska School Activities Association. He says ASA tries to hold tournaments in as many different parts of the state as possible.
We've been in the southeast over the last 10 years. We went to Ketchikan for 4A wrestling in 2003, and then 1A, 2A wrestling about 3 years ago in Sitka, and now here in Juneau.
Juneau bid on the state soccer tournament 3 years ago, and Andrews says he's happy to finally see it happen.
It's the culminating event of the year, and it's under the most incredible conditions in one of the most scenic areas of the state of Alaska, so got to be happy.
Lenhart says the best part for him is being able to suit up more players. When JDHS travels to state tournaments, it can't always afford to bring a full squad.
So we would limit ourselves to 16 or 17 players, and now I get to involve a lot more players. So that part's the best part of all.
Because he's a sophomore, right wing Heston Allred is probably one of the players who wouldn't travel if the tournament were held in Anchorage. Upperclassmen are often favored when it comes to travel. Allred says the experience should benefit JDHS down the road.
It's really good for us to get out here and get to see how higher-end players get to play, and we pick up some of their techniques and get to see the plays and just put it in the back of our mind for when we come out here next year.
The state soccer tournament goes through Saturday with the girls' championship game at 1 p.m. and boys at 3:30 at Adair Kennedy Park. In all, 14 teams, 7 boys and 7 girls squads, are competing in the tournament. Each team brings up to 22 players plus coaches and fans. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
A Homer woman has found a unique way to help residents of the Gulf Coast as they fight the growing Gulf oil spill. She's collecting human hair and animal fur for a new type of oil containment boom. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
The idea began with a San Francisco-based nonprofit group called Matter of Trust, which began collecting human hair and animal fur from all over the country shortly after the oil spill.
They've found a way to make these booms out of human hair and animal hair, and they stuffed them into basically glorified pantyhose. But what they discovered is that the human hair and animal fur attracts oil, but it doesn't absorb it. So these booms are used to corral the oil and also used to keep it from hitting the shoreline, and then they can go through and scoop it up.
That's Lauren Scharf, who first heard about the idea a few weeks ago and soon began a local campaign in the Homer area to collect as much human hair and animal fur as she could.
I heard about it here on the same day that I was shaving my girlfriend's cat. And I thought, what a shame. This fur, you know, can't go to a good cause. It kind of grew out of that. So the cat is the poster kitty for this campaign. And Homer's amazing. Every salon in Homer and dog groomer and alpaca farm, they've all come through.
Matter of Trust is using donated space in 19 warehouses all over the Gulf Coast states to store the hair and fur while it's being made into boom.
Every day at noon, they send out another update telling you if you got the email today and you're ready to ship hair, send it here, send it here, send it here. And they have volunteers, thousands of volunteers who spend their days stuffing the hair.
BP said on Monday that it is not on board with using hair-filled boom to clean up the spill. Mark Salt, a BP spokesperson based in Houston, said the company is using something called sorbent boom, which is made of materials that attract oil but repel water. Salt told the Associated Press that BP had ample supply of sorbent boom in the Gulf Coast area, and there was, quote, no need to consider the need for alternative products. The U.S. Coast Guard has also said it will not use the hair boom to clean up the spill. Matter of Trust, however, continues to distribute the hair stuff boom to various governmental organizations with expertise in hazardous materials. They say their growing stockpile of boom will ultimately reduce the cleanup costs for local governments. In Homer, Scharf is dealing with a growing stockpile of her own.
Like, at this point, we have about 150 pounds of hair and fleece. Most of that fleece coming from the Anchor River Llama and Alpaca Ranch in Anchor Point. And they gave us, oh gosh, like 80 pounds of fleece. So I'm kind of looking for donations just to help with shipping.
Scharf says she expects her total shipping cost to be in the neighborhood of about $250. She plans to go around town collecting a final load of hair and animal fur before shipping it off early next week. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.